Welcome to another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network, sponsored by TBILaw.com.
For automatic reminders about this radio show and other great survivor events,
sign up now for TBISN.org.
When Attorney Gordon Johnson speaks about recovery, he isn't talking about the amount of money a survivor gets from a lawsuit or settlement. He is talking about getting better from the brain injury. Find him on the web at TBILaw.com or call 800-992-9447.
And now, it is time for another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
Hello, welcome to Brain Injury Radio Network. Tonight is our regular Wednesday installment of our program Recovery Now with your host, Kim Justice. If you'd like to know more about my story, you can find it at inaflash.org. I, too, am a fellow traumatic brain injury survivor. I appreciate you tuning in tonight, and as always, I look forward to your input. So now, we'll get on with the show. Hello, everybody, and welcome to tonight's program. Very happy you're all here. I see some of the regulars in the room. Let's see, where do I want to start tonight? Maybe the title of the show, The Walking Dead. Was that the name of it? Yeah, The Walking Dead. I mean no offense to anybody out there, but one thing I do know is that in the process of my ruptured brain aneurysm, I encountered a near-death experience, and I have heard a number of you talk about such experiences that you've had yourselves. And so, you know, it's interesting. I heard one of you mention Jill Bolte, the gal who wrote Stroke of Insight. And it was interesting. I corresponded with her and a number of people when my book was a manuscript, asking them to read through my asking them if they would read through my manuscript and if they were on board with it, write, you know, a little blurb in the front of my book before it was published. And Jill had some interesting things to say about near-death experiences. She wanted to argue the point of being dead, and obviously we're not dead. We're here. At least I'm here talking on the show, and you're all here listening. So while we didn't literally cross over for keeps, a lot of us had an experience, and I'll tell you a little bit about mine in a minute. But first, I wanted to talk about something else for just a minute, and it is related. A few weeks ago, it was actually December 23rd, so it was the night before I was going into 48 hours of intensive family time around the holidays. I mentioned to you guys that I had gotten a telephone call that a friend of mine who just a couple weeks before, so we're talking around the 10th of December maybe, had mentioned at lunch with a group of us that her vision was kind of blurry and she needed to go get her eyes checked. And we didn't see her for a couple weeks, but it was busy Christmas time, so a lot of people were missing to this weekly meeting and we didn't think much of it. And then on the night of the 23rd, I got a phone call from a mutual friend to say that this woman, Marty, had gone to the doctor, had spent 5 days in the hospital getting tests, and that she went directly from the hospital to a hospice and went completely blind over the course of 3 days, suffering from an inoperable brain tumor. And she died last night. I just found out a couple of hours ago. And it's interesting, in my book on the acknowledgments page, I say, to my mom, who has pestered me to get this book written for years, to David, who motivated me to quote-unquote write on without fear, Marty, who introduced me to the writers group and supported my efforts from the beginning, Jim C., who edited my first draft attempts years ago patiently and with encouragement, and Shelley, who coached me through the first edits this time and graciously challenged my thinking. Was that a dangling participle, a hanging Chad, or vice versa? Interestingly, of those people that I just read about, Marty is the person who introduced me to the writers group, and if that introduction hadn't been made, if she wouldn't have been that bridge person in my life, my manuscript would probably still be down in a plastic tub, my book wouldn't be written, and I wouldn't be here tonight doing a radio show. Yes, Jenny, that this is the lady that we put the rose petals in her hand. Marty was a pivotal person in getting me here tonight talking. The other one that I mentioned in here, Jim C., he was an old newspaper editor back in the old days when they sent him out on the beat, had a million great stories. Earlier this year, he's still breathing, but he's in another state now with a child. Dementia set in. With him, and he doesn't know if he's on foot or horseback at this point. And Shelley, who I mentioned, I only mentioned five names, and one of them was my mom, one of them was David. The other three in the last year is the point, have suffered brain issues, and none of them had them before. Shelley, who I mentioned here at the end, in October got a brain tumor that was cancerous with her. They were able to do surgery, and they got all but 30% of it. And she was blessed to be able to be here for the birth of her first grandchild in October, and to be here for the holidays. And she's having a good recovery, but will be facing some further treatment. And I guess I find a couple ironies. My book was about my ruptured brain aneurysm, near-death experience, recovery experience, and really a book about miracles and God. And three of the people that I had read the manuscript first all have had, and my book just came out December 14th, so just over a year ago, this time last year. So all within a year, two people got brain tumors and one got dementia. And when I went to visit Marty last time, and it's been a few days back, I could tell she was in the transition. She wasn't conscious anymore. They had her very heavily sedated. But last Thursday, a girlfriend came up and said that she had been to see Marty, and she thought that maybe the drugs were taking hold, because she reached out her arm. She had been completely out of it, and she reached out her arm and said, "What a handsome waistcoat. Do you see that gorgeous man?" Marty had a really good sense of humor. And my friend Sally said, so I think the drugs were kicking in. And another thing that I've heard people in our audience talk about is the fact that once we've had a brain, a TBI or a near-death experience, that some of us notice that we get a little more empathy, sympathy, passion, and maybe have a little more intuitive thought, or are empaths of some sort. I intuitively knew the way that Sally was describing what Marty said, and knowing Marty as I do, that person she saw, I'll bet you anything, it wasn't any drug illusion, but it was a familiar, somebody from the other side that was helping her transition from the human plane over into the spiritual realm. And she knew who that person was. And in fact, I asked Sally that. I said, "Did you get the feeling it was someone she knew?" And she said, "Oh, definitely." And I told her what my thought was, and that seemed to bring Sally some comfort. But I truly believed what I told her. And one of the reasons that I believed that is because of the experience I had myself, which I talk about in my book. I'm going to briefly tell you a little bit about my near-death experience, and then I encourage you to call in and share with me your thoughts or any near-death experience that you had. I know that for a long time there was a few people. Mine happened in 1995, and when I came out, I think this audience will understand better than just about anybody I would tell this to. But you know, when you come out of the brain deal, and everybody tells you that you should be so grateful, and you look great, and they want you to be normal, and you want to be normal, and if you make any complaints, they give you drugs or send you over to the shrink bone pile. Yeah, that was for you, Les Paul. Tell you you're crazy and that kind of thing. So the last thing you want to do on top of all of that is tell them about your near-death experience. If they didn't already think you were crazy, that certainly probably would get you locked up. So for the most part, I kept my mouth shut. I did tell my mother. She believed me. She believed me. I'll leave it at that. I told the person who was my fiancé at the time, and who incidentally I was putting through medical school, and his opinion is that it was a hallucination from the drugs that I was on in my surgery. And I knew with every fiber of my being that he was dead wrong, that what I experienced was real as the sun coming up in the morning. But I didn't feel the need, first time in my life, I'm not quite sure what happened here, but I didn't feel the need to argue with him, convince him, sell him, educate him, or even ever discuss it with him again. We just didn't talk about it again. And he was certainly entitled to his thought. I was certainly entitled to my reality, my new reality. It wasn't something I asked for. It was a gift that I was given. And I told people on an as-needed basis over the last 17 years, meaning that I thought if it was something that would bring someone comfort, or that there was a reason that I was being told to share with a person, then I did. And other than that, I certainly didn't go public with it any more than I did things about my brain rupture and the struggles that I had afterward. I had the guilt and the shame that a lot of you talk about my illness. Already was having relatives and friends and medical professionals challenging me. And so I just shut up. I just shut up like a lot of us do and went through that depression and that dark time that a lot of us go through. Even though some really incredible things had happened, I didn't have anyone to share those things with, except on a rare occasion when I would run into somebody that I knew was safe. But in any case, I'm not going to go through my whole book. What I will tell you is that when I was in a coma, I was in a coma for 11 days, and at some point, it would be as if you were laying on the couch and somebody put a swath of green cloth over your eyes so that all you could see when you opened your eyes was green. And I became aware out of this coma I was in at some point that I didn't see my body, but I felt that I was looking out my eyes. I felt like me. And I became aware, my first awareness was of the color green. And it was curious because the green was brighter, sharper, and more intense than any color I had ever seen in my life. And I've got bad vision problems since my eyes weren't great before, but after my rupture, I started having... have had a lot of vision trouble. But if any of you have vision trouble, you know that when you put your glasses on, things come a little more into focus. They're sharper, they're tighter. But in the case of me seeing this green, it was so sharp, so tight, so crisp that you can't even really compare it to putting on a pair of glasses, because it wasn't like anything I've seen in the human existence. It was that intense. The color was almost alive. And soon I was backing up. The color was backing up, backing up, backing up until I became aware of a sprig of a pine-type tree. And I saw the little brown knobbies on the branch and the pine needles. And I remember looking at it in wonder. It was almost as if I were part of the tree because I was so up on it. It was right in my face. And again, this intensity, this sharpness of color. And it keeps backing up, panning back, and suddenly I'm standing then next to this tree, looking out over a grassy expanse with a bright blue sky and a fluffy white cloud that kind of blew by, and I became aware of a crowd of people out yonder. And the first thing I noticed is that they were in period clothing. So some of them were dressed like, you know, pioneers, and some of them were dressed like you and me would dress today. There was just a lot of different period-type clothing. And at that moment, a little girl ran through my field of vision from the right to the left, and she was in a pioneer type of clothing. She had long blonde hair and ribbons tying her hair back, and a little white apron thing, and she was playing that game where it's like a hula hoop rolling in front of them and they're guiding it with a stick. And I remember seeing this little girl run from left to right, excuse me, it was from right to left, through my field of vision, and I remember smiling at her innocence and the joy that she was getting out of playing this game. And right when she ran through, my eyes came to rest on a gentleman who had his back to me. And my eyes were focused down at the back of his shoes. And as I started panning up his body, he was beginning to turn around so that at the point my eyes locked on his, he had turned around enough that when my eyes got up to his head, our eyes locked. And I knew instantly I had that recognition of my grandpa, who had died about a decade before. My grandpa is still the only man who could ever get me up at 4 o'clock in the morning. We used to be fishing buddies, and I was the only grandchild on that side for 18 years. I had a real close relationship with my grandfather, and his death had come quick and as a shocking surprise. He just dropped dead of a heart attack one day, so he was there and then he was gone. Boom, that was the end of it. And so suddenly here I am seeing my grandpa. One thing I did note is that my grandpa was younger than I had ever known him in life. My grandpa, I should say, was a short, balding, graying Italian man with a big belly. Looked like he was 10 months pregnant, had this great big belly. And so even though he had a little more hair and it was a little darker when I was little, for the most part, the whole time I knew my grandpa, which I was about 23 when he passed away. So for 23 years, you know, he was balding and varying shades of gray until it was all gray and just about all bald. But the grandpa I saw was when he was maybe in his teens, later teens or 20s. But still, I didn't even doubt for a moment or think about it. It was him. That recognition was instantly there. It was him. And I went to take a step to go toward him. It was almost like when you're at a party. You walk into a party and you're kind of shy. You don't know anybody yet. So you hang back and kind of observe what's going on until you see someone you know. And then, you know, you smile and you try to move toward him. And that's what I did. Our eyes locked. I felt this joy, and I went to take a step to go towards him, and boom, it was as if I had hit a piece of plexiglass, and it was over. I was back in my body, back in that coma, and aware of that pain that never went away from the moment my aneurysm had ruptured, and totally out of it. And again, I can't tell you what point in the 11 days of that coma that happened, but my mom had been sitting in my room next to me after they had taken out the ventilator. It was about 3 days after surgery. I still hadn't gained consciousness. I hadn't talked. Nothing had happened yet. But she thought she heard me mumble something, and then because I hadn't talked, she thought she was wrong or that it was wishful thinking. But what I had said are the colors are so bright. And interestingly, a few weeks after I was out of the hospital and home, I didn't immediately remember that near-death experience. It started coming back to me in pieces, and it started one day when they were driving me to a doctor's appointment, and it was very bright out. And I remember, you know, that's when that light sensitivity was really bad. And so I had on these dark glasses, but the sun refracted off of a sign, and I saw that rainbow thing. And for a moment, I got that momentary memory that blazed through my consciousness of that bright, living, breathing color that I had seen. And then over the next few days, the whole incident, the whole episode came back to me. And I said, that was when I told my mom about it. And I said, and the colors were so bright. And my mom just got goosebumps and tears in her eyes. And she said, oh my God, I didn't imagine it. She said, we still didn't even know if you were going to make it, what shape you were going to come back in, if you were going to come back to consciousness at all. It was another 3 days, she said, but when they took the ventilator out, the next day I was sitting there in the room and I thought I heard you mumble, the colors are so bright. But you weren't conscious, you didn't get conscious in the next day or so I thought I imagined it. But that was one of the reasons that she absolutely believed me, is she heard me say it when I really wasn't even conscious, and then heard me say it again when I recounted what I had seen in my near-death experience. Now, I've got someone on hold, and you guys can go ahead and get ready to start calling in if you like. I'm going to make my closing comments about my experience. I don't have the answers to everything, but there's a couple things that I think are my truths, and one of them is that I absolutely believe that life continues after we die, basically that the body is the carrying case for the soul in the human existence. And we're all in the human existence now, and our soul is riding in our body. And when our body gives out like an old car, our spirit leaves our body and goes to the spiritual plane, whether you want to call that heaven, which I do, or wherever, whatever you choose to name it. And that the whole thing is divinely orchestrated by, I say God, you say whoever, all comes down to the same thing. A lot of us believe in a higher power, regardless of what we choose to call he, she, it, her. We also, a lot of us believe in a next in a spiritual realm, whether you want to call that heaven or whatever you'd like to call it. I don't want to get into the semantics with people or even argue or challenge a point. I'm simply sharing my experience. And so I believe that in my case, I'm not going to say in heaven, because personally I feel that if you've actually been to heaven, you don't come back. Once, to me, and again, my opinion, once you've crossed over and you're there in the spiritual realm. I liken my experience more to being somewhat akin to the pearly gates, where I made a journey. I was allowed to see that my soul will take a journey out of my body, and it will come to the precipice or the pearly gates or the entryway to heaven or whatever you choose to call it. And that's where my familiars will greet me. And I believe that since we're a human making a transition into a spiritual plane, that my God makes these familiars, who are fully spiritual beings at this point, but he makes them look like humans, so that as my human existence is fading and transitioning into a fully spiritual place, I'm going to recognize and feel safe, loved, curious, secure, and a lot of positive adjectives I can use to describe the experience I had. I was never once afraid. I was never once cautious. The only words I can use to describe it is wonder. I had a huge sense of wonder. I had a warm sense of love, and I wanted very much to stay. But I was sent back. Now, do I know why? No, not exactly. All I know is that I was gifted enough to see, to have a spiritual experience, and then to be able to share it. And there's some reason for that. And again, as I mentioned in the program notes, for those of you that might have read them, when any one of our voices talks about our TBI or our brain trauma or the caregiver experience or near-death experience, when any one voice says it, and DJ's been talking a lot about things that go on in the Social Security system, a fight that he's having right now. And I think we've all experienced that when it's one voice, we simply don't get heard, especially if it's something controversial or difficult for somebody else to understand or deal with. We just aren't heard. We're not validated. But when it's a huge number of voices saying the same thing, then that's really hard for even the greatest skeptic to deny. And I don't know, for whatever the reason, Marty, I'm glad that she didn't have to suffer any longer than she did. I'm happy she's free from the pain she was experiencing in the human existence. And I'm sad to lose her in the human existence, but I know where she is, and she's doing a heck of a lot better tonight. I'm going to put on Keith Anthony for just a minute. Sorry, guys.
Hi, Kim, and good morning from London, UK, where it's 3:30 a.m. and still dark. That was a wonderful account that you were giving there, Kim, of your near-death experience.
Thanks.
Would you like to relate it to mine, which had some very similar elements?
Please, go ahead. Why don't you talk a minute and tell
yours? Yeah, and I don't recall it as clearly as you do, But I recall a lot of snatches, and you were talking about the spirit leaving the body. It's all semantics, really, how you think about it. But I think that we're a spiritual being having a physical existence here, and that what leaves is the physical body leaves the spirit, as I believe the spirit is always there. And from my experience, I saw when I was up in the place we call heaven, I saw everybody, and I mean everybody, everybody I'd ever known, everybody I ever would know. And I met people who were both alive and still alive and dead. So that tells me that our spirit is still connected with heaven, and the physical body just brings us down onto this plane. And once the physical body is gone, then the physical body just snaps back into wherever it was, and it's no longer burdened by the weight of this shell that we wear that feels all the pain and suffering. When I had my near-death experience, I can remember going along the famous tunnel of light, and I was being guided by, I guess, what you call familiars. I'm not sure that I could actually see them, but they were speaking into my mind, telling me not to divert at all from the path, and to focus only on the light, because to the left and the right was what I call limbo, and there was anguish. I could feel it in my body. I could feel fear that I might fall off of that path and go and join them, because I knew that it was very close. It was so close that, you know, you could virtually smell it if it had a smell. But I went along the path and until I reached the light at the end. And you were saying, Kim, that you couldn't remember exactly when things happened, and I don't either, because I sort of described things in a particular order, but there was no order. Everything, if I could describe it accurately, I would suggest that everything that we experience happens simultaneously and probably quicker than that, because time doesn't seem to be a feature when you're up on the spiritual plane there.
Right.
It's a construct that we create down here on Earth.
Yeah.
We're the only creature on the planet that's invented clocks. You don't see lions and tigers with clocks, do you? They don't need them. They just rely on the sun coming up every day, and they accept that it's going to happen the next day.
But I
went for a period. I have the perception that this happened first after the tunnel, but as I said, everything happened simultaneously, more likely. But I went into a small room, probably about as big as my living room here, which is about 30 feet long and about 15-20 feet wide, and I was aware that I was in some kind of a spiritual plane somehow, as I was getting a lot of thoughts in my head. You know, I was having entities communicating with me by thought transfer. And the first thing that surprised me was that I looked at my body and I was wearing clothes, and I couldn't understand what possible business clothes had in this place, because I was, as far as I could tell, a spirit.
Hmm.
And it didn't seem to me that I needed clothes, although I did have clothes on. And I think the reason for that, as you described to all the people you saw wearing various kinds of clothes, I think that's because we're not ready for the full truth. And so we see these things to help us make the transition and make things as normal as we can. Because the place that we go to, there's nothing normal about that place. It's beyond our imagination.
Right.
So I think everything I saw in that place was shown to me in a way that I could understand. So as us hypnotists say, we use a lot of metaphor. We tell stories and describe things in a graphic way to help people understand where we're going. And I think that this place was no different.
Right.
And there were entities with me that I could see, but I'm very confused about how many of them there was. To this day, I've wrangled with my mind thinking, was that one person, or was it two, or was it three? Mm-hmm. And it's hard for me to remember because I had amnesia when I came round. So it's a lot. It's very difficult to remember things too clearly. But in this room, the thing that surprised me about this room was that it had wood paneling halfway up the wall, and the rest of the room was brilliant white. The walls above the paneling were white. The ceiling was white, and it was the most brilliant white that I'd ever seen. You could imagine that if you touched it, it would just suck you in. And it was such a powerful white. And in this room, which was very much like a courtroom, I thought to myself at the time, there was a white fluted pedestal. And I've only recently, in fact, only since I've been describing it on Brain Injury Radio, have I been able to describe that pedestal as a white fluted pedestal, because I couldn't remember what you call that stuff where you have the vertical lines going up a pillar.
Right.
Or a white fluted pillar, in fact, and on the top of it was a lectern with a big heavy bound book, which was my life story. And some people would call that the Akashic record. It's got the record of everything in it.
Right.
And I was taken through that book, but I didn't read the book. I was shown the contents of the book in graphical and image format, as in a video. I saw my entire existence, my entire life, from the beginning to the end and beyond. Yes. So I think that I was shown the future as well, which is possibly why every time I meet somebody, I'm convinced I've met them before and I already know them. And the strange thing is that very often people who meet me say to me exactly the same. They say, "Have we met before?" And I will sometimes explain to them, "Well, yes, we probably did, because I had a near-death experience, and maybe it's something to do with that." And that usually blows most people's minds, and they start running away from me. They think I'm mental, and perhaps I am. I don't know. But others take it very well. But I was in there, and the thing I remember. I don't remember it that clearly. But I seem to remember that as I went through that book and saw all the events, I was being judged. And the person who was judging me was myself. I was looking at everything from the eyes, my own eyes, and from the eyes of all the people that I'd been, and all the animals and creatures that I'd been interacting with. So I could see if I'd done something good to them, then I felt it. And if I'd done something bad to them, then I felt how bad they felt when I did that. And that was in some ways marvelous, and in some ways that was terrible. It's quite I forgive me for explaining in this way. You could almost imagine what it's like for a young boy when his mother bursts in and catches him with a dirty magazine or doing things to himself that perhaps we shouldn't talk about on air, and he would be horrified, wouldn't he? And that's exactly how I felt when I felt like I'd been exposed. But I was the one who was being the judge, and that was a bit weird too. But in that room at some point, they showed me a door. And when I say a door, I'm not sure whether there was more than one door or whether it was one door. But I have an impression there was more than one door, but I couldn't swear to it. But they wanted me to go through this door at some point. And I asked them what's on the other side. They said to me, you don't need to know. You just need to go through that door. And I said, but I need to know what's on the other side of that door. And they said, but you don't need to know. Just trust us. Just go through the door. And I argued with them. And I'm thinking, I'm up here arguing with people who are immensely more powerful than I will ever be. And I'm thinking, I'm standing here arguing with these gods, perhaps they were, about this door. And it seemed very strange to me at the time, but I was adamant that I was not going to be stupid enough to go through a door without knowing what was on the other side, because it could have been, for all I know, it could have been the limbo that I'd seen on the way up. It could have been a bottomless pit. It could have been a bunch of alligators. I didn't know what was on the other side of the door. And they insisted, well, you have to. It's always been done this way. Everybody does it this way. Ever since, you know, the beginning of everything, everybody has always done it this way. And I said, well, I haven't been here. It's the first time I've been here, and now it's going to be different because I'm here. And I was really obstinate about it. And I can't remember what happened. I suspect that I didn't go through the door in the end. And then I moved on perhaps to other things, but I can't remember exactly what happened at that point. But that and these are like scenes from a play, and you might imagine that some of the scenes are missing because I can't remember everything that happened. But I can remember whether it was before or after going into this room, I don't know. But I have the perception that it was after. But I've also formed this opinion that there is no time up there. So
right.
I'm only talking about whether it's before or after because I'm back in my physical body and these things are important to us.
Right.
But when I was up there, I probably would have understood a lot better. But I did go through a period where, although I can't describe it to you now, I can't say whether it was a forest of trees or whether it was a rainbow, whatever it was. I can remember it was very beautiful. Whatever it was very profound, very beautiful, very intense experience. But I can't describe it to you. I just know I had it, whatever it was. But I also met everybody that I'd ever known from
yes.
the past and into the future as well. And I can't remember how they were dressed, but when you were talking about them being in period costumes, that sort of opened up a slight recall. I'm thinking, is that what I saw? And I'd like to think it was, but I couldn't swear that I did see that, or whether I'm just imagining it, because that's what you were saying, Kim.
Well, a couple of things. And I got to let a caller on here, another caller with us, but they've been holding. Thank you for your patience. Couple things, Keith Anthony, when you were talking about the white, one thing that seems to be common, and there was only one thing I failed to say, and that was just as I went to take the step, my grandpa telecommunicated how the word that you use, the words aren't spoken the way we speak. It goes mind to mind, but he said,
telepathic.
It's not time, telepathic. It's not time. So
yes.
We both experienced that telepathic communication and that color that we can only describe as almost alive, that it's
yes.
so sharp. And intense. And I remember when I heard your story before too, that it's just an incredible, it can't be described. And it's interesting because for all of the people that had thought it was medication, I know that you don't have a history. I have a history. Craig the other night was talking about dark histories or missteps in our past and in our history. And I don't know, I think I can safely say that I am 100% positive that drugs had nothing to do with the experience that
yes.
I had. And the things that have gone on to transpire since then and the understanding that's come, the stones of my path that have been laid in front of me and the people who have held up the lanterns to light that path,
mm-hmm.
lest I make a misstep, I don't believe that those are a mistake. You know, I think coincidences are God's way of working anonymously, and that's what I talk about time and time and time again in my book. You know, when people ask me what it's about, I don't say it's about a near-death experience
mm-hmm.
or a brain aneurysm. I do say that sometimes because it is,
yes.
but it's mostly, my book is about God and miracles and
mm-hmm.
Living. When only 3% survive that ruptured brain aneurysm and being
mm-hmm.
able to see the spiritual plane are certainly instances of God and miracles. And I just,
yes.
when my friend was...
Mm-hmm.
the other night reaching out to the handsome man
mm-hmm.
in the attractive waistcoat
yes.
in front of someone else, I knew she saw someone she knew, and I understood instantly.
Yeah.
I understood instantly that was someone coming to help her transition,
mm-hmm.
someone that she wasn't afraid of, that
yeah.
she was happy to see, and it just resonated so deeply, and I haven't had an experience like that since I had my own. But I appreciate you sharing. I'm keeping you, but I'm going to go ahead and put on caller 763. You're on the air.
Good evening, Kim. It's Matt. How is everybody tonight?
Hi, Matt.
Hello,
I'm fabulous.
Matt.
Hi. Just hopped on about 10, 15 minutes ago and been listening, so enjoying the show. I don't know what's going on.
We're talking heaven and stuff, aren't we?
Yeah.
I have a story. Could I share it?
Sure.
We want to hear it.
Okay, so when I got hit by the semi-truck and I was dead on the scene for 9 minutes and they brought me back to life and they used all the oxygen and everything on me and they brought me back to life and in between there I left my body and I never believed in that stuff and I heard you guys talking. I was going towards the light and I had this overwhelming calmness about me and I had no fears and I had no worries and it was just peace and it was all great and the sky was beautiful blue. And I was moving into this light, and I went over my friends that were in the accident with me, and I checked over all of them. And I was able to, when I came out of a coma, I was able to describe where everybody was. I couldn't hardly talk. Anyways, it went black. And when I described the story to my mother, she had told the doctor, and he said that I had an out-of-body experience and that when I was died, I left my body and when it went black is when they brought me back to life and I recovered in the hospital. But is that a kind of along the lines of what you guys were talking about?
Exactly.
Yeah. So
that's exactly
that was my experience.
What we're talking about.
And again, you know, growing up watching Oprah and all these shows and just like, really, you know, like people have out-of-body experiences. And like, I was kind of like, come on, you know, but I totally agree with, you know, what you guys have been through and what I've been through. I mean, I don't think we just make that up. I mean, it's definitely an experience I had in my life and I'm grateful for it because, again, like you guys were saying about the spiritual plane, and it just makes me feel good inside knowing there is, you know, something after life, and I believe in that. You know, I had proof. So.
Yeah. Well, I think that's great that you called in and shared that, Matt. You know, one thing I want to share with you guys, and that's... Sorry, I'm trying to read my... Okay, I'll come back and read Matt's note. But and then I lost my train of thought because I was trying to... Okay, Matt, it's Matt. Matt, that's what I wanted to share. I'm not going to look at the chat board for a second, so I'm going to focus. But
Matt from St. Louis?
No.
Matt Dawson?
You, Matt? No, I was... It's Matt in the chat box is Matt from Indiana, and that's the one that I'm muffing that I'm not going to read the chat board right now because I'm focusing on this Matt. I'm sharing from Minnesota and now North Carolina, Matt. The Matt that's
Thank
on
you.
The line with us right now. Mm. It's interesting because I don't know when, a few months back, I met Matt on a different program, totally unrelated. And neither of us knew that we had had brain trauma incidences, and neither of us knew until this moment that we both had out-of-body experiences. It's interesting, I think. So, anyway,
agreed.
I mean, Matt...
Agreed,
Matt,
I agreed, yeah.
could I add something, Kim?
Yeah, please. Matt and I are probably kind of blown away about now, huh?
My arms are standing up.
We get these doctors and people like that who try to tell us that it's the medication or what kind of stuff. But I've interviewed a lot of people who've had near-death experiences, and I've interviewed who I believe to be some very sincere people, but I've also interviewed one or two people who were just very strange, and I suspect hadn't had a near-death experience at all. But the thing that makes you sound very genuine, Kim, and myself and Matt there, we don't go over the top about our experiences, do we? We don't start making up the bits that we don't remember. I mean,
no.
I confess that I don't remember most of it, and I'm not prepared to make up the bits that I don't know so that
right.
I can fill a book with it. So
right.
I think we tend to... I think that you come across to me, if I'd never heard of near-death experiences and you told me about yours, I would think that you were telling the truth, because you're not building it up, you're not boosting it bigger than anything that it really is. And am I making sense here?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Because,
so
I
would say that you are very coherent about your experience. You don't strike me as being somebody who was in some kind of... A drug frenzy or a drug daze or anything like that, under the influence of alcohol or whatever it might be, that might
no.
make you see strange things. And I'm sure those things would make you see strange things. But you sound very sincere. You sound very balanced about your description. And that tells me that you're telling me the truth. And I suspect that when I talk to people, I probably convey about the same.
Absolutely, yeah.
But the doctors will still tell us that it was the drugs, because they don't have the capacity for anything else, do they? That their mind isn't big enough to imagine anything else going on.
Right. And I was just thinking about the. I just wanted to clarify something. Well, anyway, I'll get back to Sarah, too. Tonight, for some reason, I'm having a hard time doing the chat, so I'm just going to focus on the show and leave the chat to the chat. But, yeah, you know, like, both of you saw the light tunnel, the white tunnel, whatever. You know, if a person was going to, you know, I don't remember that. There might have been one, but my first awareness came with the color green, and... That's just the way it was. And, you know, what's funny, too, is that I do know about the drugs, you know, the pain medicine, because there are parts of things around, you know, from the time I walked into the hospital, and then I don't remember anything for 11 days except for till I came to life again, got conscious again. And I do remember the grogginess and everything of waking up then, you know, and the pain medicine, they give you that grogginess and that feeling that isn't clear. And I couldn't go back and tell you what I felt like those first nights I was laying in the hospital or whatever. I don't remember any of that. But why is the NDE part so crisp, clear, concise, just in my brain? Somebody who can't remember what she had for lunch, you know, because my short-term memory is so screwed up now.
Mm-hmm.
And I was under the influence of stuff around the experience. But it wasn't that, because that stuff I was under the influence of was making me forgetful, groggy, everything the opposite.
Mm.
Of what having a memory of a near-death experience
yes.
is. You wouldn't remember it with that clarity of thought. And like you said, the detail and being able to be honest about just what you saw and not projecting stuff that other people, whatever, you know, it has nothing to do with that. It was the message that we were supposed to be given for whatever reason. And I think the rest of our life's journey is working toward, well, I think we saw that there was what you said, a higher power, that there was a God, and so there's God's will and there's our will in the human existence. And I think being given that experience, one of the things that we tend to do for the rest of our human journey has to do with service and sharing the message and being more in line with God's will than perhaps being as into self-will as we were before we had these experiences.
Yes.
And that our purpose ultimately will be formed out of it.
Yeah,
whatever that purpose is.
I think our purpose here is to learn to button down that ego that we all have, particularly us men. We've got to learn to rein in our ego and look after each other instead of ourselves, because we all tend to focus on ourselves. But since I started helping and looking after other people and giving my stuff away to other people, I felt such a difference in my life. I feel so much happier than I ever did before, because I'm not holding on to stuff and trying to collect stuff as most people do. I prefer to give it away. You know, when I get money, I don't think twice about giving it away now. I never used to be like that. But I think this is the lesson we're here to learn, that we are put here for each other, not ourselves. And when we learn that, I can only assume that everybody else, if they learn that, is going to be as happy as I am. And
right.
It's had a profound effect on me. And that free will thing that we have, that's very important, because we don't understand what that's all about. But I've been meditating lately and thinking about that a lot. And it's come to me that free will is very important. I think I wrote this in Facebook recently. Thank you, Sarah, for that comment. I hope I haven't missed any other comments that people are saying. But the free will is very important, because if we can use our free will in a directed way, then we're taught free will because our minds are powerful. Because we have free will, we can decide what we want to do. And if you decide to do fantastic things, they will manifest. And I've proved this because I've done it myself. And when you use the power of that, and think of the power in the mind as a kind of energy that you can direct, and it's making my fingers tingle while I say it. Imagine your mind is a powerful force that you can direct, because you've got the freedom of that will to direct it where you want to. And you can use that free will to heal people's sickness. I'm talking about laying on of hands and that kind of thing. And I've done this. And on one occasion when I did this, a dead man burst, and I mean burst, back into life. It was as if I'd electrocuted him. But it wasn't me. I was just the channel. And the power was coming from spirit or God or Jesus or wherever it was. And that man burst into life because I made this decision in my mind that I'd never, ever thought of anything like that before this moment. But that man's life was on the line. He was already dead. He had no time. And I needed to make a quick choice that I was all he had. And that may have been an inflated ego, whatever it was. But it worked.
Anthony, thank you. I want to thank our sponsor, Gordon Johnson. Check out tbilaw.com if you have any legal issues along with your TBI. We're coming to the end of the show. The live callers, we will roll into overtime. So if you do dial in, we'll continue on with the show. Our live callers and those who have to leave now, thank you so much for being here on the show tonight. We appreciate your support here at Brain Injury Radio. I'm going to close the show in the usual way. For those of you who are staying, I will be back with you in 51 seconds. And I'm going to close in my usual way with something I believe we all have, and that is a guardian angel. Thanks so much.
God replies, yes, it's your time to leave. But don't you worry, you won't be there alone. You see, there's someone who's been waiting for you. Quietly hoping and praying, everyone is. God.
no other. Okay, we're on the other side of the hour. Gosh, I was doing really good. I thought I remembered everything except telling people the number to call in on. So thanks for those of you who have stayed on the line. I am going to unmute area code 765. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
You okay tonight, honey? You sound a little down in the dumps. Matt. It's Matt.
Yes, I know, Matt. I knew it was Muffin Man. No, I'm generally okay. I have feelings. You know, that is, you do bring up something good that maybe the others, the other Matt and Keith Anthony would support, and that's that even though I know that my friend is in a better place, and when I found out what was wrong with her and where she was headed, I was praying she'd get there fast. That was my prayer for her, that she would go quickly because she wasn't going to get better. But it doesn't mean you don't have human feelings about losing a friend, you know, in the human existence. For her, I'm happy. For me, I'm a little sad. That's all.
Right, and isn't it strange that way that, you know, we want to go, and then when they go, I mean, we don't want them to go, but we want them to get out of pain, and then when they go, it's so heartening. You know, I was that way with my mother. She had a stroke, and it took her about 4 months to live through her coma before she passed away, and it was a relief, but it was so painful, you know? Hard to explain, I guess.
Well, and it's not like we...
Hard to explain.
Yeah. Well, we didn't have the kind of relationship that, I mean, you and your mom did. Marty and I were acquaintances, and I, like I said, it's interesting. There's the people like you're talking about, loved ones and relatives and things like that, and then there's your dear friends, and then there's some people I would call not just acquaintances, because something happens. It's like flipping on a light switch. It's a puzzle person. It's a connector person. Somebody that you wouldn't normally have in your life, wouldn't normally be in your life, but something brought the two of you together, and that linked you to something else. Without that person having crossed your path at that time and locking into your energy field at that moment, the rest of what unfolded for me couldn't have.
Then do you feel like that's an empty link now or something, or is still something that you can share in your heart?
No, her and my relationship met its purpose. Just as another human being, I mean, none of us are going to get out of this alive. We'll establish that right up front.
A minute. I already have 4 times, damn it. I'm going to keep going.
Eventually, they're going to get us. And
only 5 more to go, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I don't know how many times we're going to get a whack at the bat here, but, you know, more than some, for sure, already, more than most, but nonetheless, at some point, they're going to keep us, you know, on the other side of that deal. So it's just, yeah. It was quick. I mean, my grandpa, you know, for the family he left behind, it was excruciating because of the suddenness of it. For him, it had to be the best way to die. You know, my ruptured brain aneurysm, if I would have died and not lived through that, that would have been pretty sweet, actually, of a way to go. My dad has Parkinson's. He was diagnosed with it a couple of years ago, and I'm starting to understand a little bit about that, how that works. And You know, people I know that have had long protracted cancers, you know, long,
can you hear me,
long, Sam? Painful deaths. I'm sorry, Matt?
If I could interject, you said it would have been sweet, but I think of this picture. Look at your greater purpose in here and passing on the message of survival and giving so many people hope and you know, helping so many people. Look at that purpose. And then someday we will have, you know, I don't know. I think that's sweet.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I didn't mean that this isn't sweet and that I'm not grateful. What I meant is under the deal that none of us are going to, you know, make it out of this alive as far as ways to go. I would rather have something quick, like my grandpa's just had a heart attack, boom, was here 1 minute, gone the next.
Oh, I hear your suffering purpose. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Believe it or not, I was told by some close friends of mine that during that 2 weeks that I was under crisis, they were just hoping I would go away. I mean, because of the family pain, and they figured I was in pain, and they were in pain themselves, and, you know, everybody's got a life to live while you're trying to survive yours, and you can only die so many, you know, you get people all built up, and then they fall down because they heard you died, then you're alive again, they get all excited, and then you die again, they go down.
Mm-hmm. Is that Les Paul?
Yes, I do have a couple other mics to open up if we're at a segue like that.
But that was Les Paul speaking, wasn't it?
No. You're on the air with us, 281.
Yes, Cam, this is James Larkin Smith. I've really enjoyed your show tonight. First off, I want to say I'm sorry for the loss of your friend. I know it's tough when something like that happens, and I think we as folks who have been through these near-death experiences have even a greater understanding of that time when this happens. So I just wanted to pass that to you tonight, and I've really enjoyed the show. I apologize I couldn't get in the chat room to the folks tonight. My Kindle doesn't always cooperate, so.
Oh, well, thank you so much for being here, and I really appreciate you calling in. Hey, congratulations on your new show. Tell the folks about it.
I'm on Thursday nights. I've been toying with this for quite a while. I'm going to be doing a show that's specific for AVM folks, people that have had arterial venous malformations, family and such. And I put this off for a couple of years. I've been doing a music-only type show in the mornings for 4 years now. And just things have just finally come together, software and some other things, the way I wanted to do it. So I'm going to be starting that tomorrow night. I can relate to your near-death. I know you mentioned Jill Hope Taylor earlier. I'm reminded of something that she mentioned in her book, and I think you mentioned some similar things in your book also. And that's that when I talk to people that I've had the experience to talk to people that have people in comas, not just because of, you know, of the things we've gone through, just other circumstances. One of the things I emphasize to them is protect the room. Because you pick up on so much stuff when you're in a coma. And all of my dreams and stuff that I had in my near-death experience, I think a lot of them were things that I picked up in the environment and the doctors and nurses talking and such like that. And then there's one particular, I mean, I definitely had some very supernatural ones also. And the one that I remember the most was the time that I had when I was in a coma, one of the things that happens when you're in a hospital and you go through all this stuff, surgery and the medications, is you tend to get infections and stuff like this. Your rate
right.
for that is astronomical. Mm-hmm. And that's where so many folks actually pass away. Not from
yes.
the surgery, but the infections or stuff. And I had a respiratory infection that got real bad, and they were very worried.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened to me that was so crazy, I had a guy that I used to work with. His name was Chris. I worked with him when I worked for the paint manufacturing company. Also went to church with him. He was my sound man in my church. And so I'm in this dream when I'm in a coma. And it's to the point where they're thinking they're going to have to reincubate me. I've been incubated one time, and they were thinking that they were going to have to do that because I was having such trouble breathing and had a respiratory infection. And in this dream I had during the coma, I'm in my hospital bed, and there's this glass partition. And outside of the glass partition are two individuals. One is Chris, my friend Chris, who was a very big individual, and it's very hard to not recognize him. And Chris used to be a volunteer EMT, and he would always tell me his crazy stories about, you know, being on accident scenes and helping folks and stuff like that, volunteer-wise. And in this dream, Chris was holding a ventilation device, and he was helping to... And for some reason in the dream, I kept saying, ventilate me, ventilate me, ventilate me, ventilate me. And like, because I realized I was having trouble breathing. But next to Chris, the supernatural part, was a young lady, I would say under 10 years old, blonde head, in a white gown type thing, that never said a word during this whole time. And of course, I personally believe that was an angel that was sent. And I just happened to do everything doctors needed at that point. I was kind of fighting them and being combative at the time and stuff. And I settled down, and they were able to give me the proper medication, and I managed to recover from the infection. So there's so many good points to the stories you've been talking about tonight, and I think that they are real to us, and something that we all, as survivors of these TBIs, can relate to.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I really appreciate you calling in, and thanks for being here and sharing what you did. That's awesome.
Thank
and
you.
Best
yeah,
wishes and good luck for your show. And I wanted to say, I typed it in the chat room, but for the people that don't know, James had an AVM. And I didn't know what that was. It's something akin to an aneurysm. It's one of those brain screw-ups. So he also has been a TBI survivor, and he happened to be the first radio host that contacted me to be interviewed on his program early last year when my book came out. And so it was amazing because I told him how green I didn't even know what internet radio was when he contacted me. And I was so green and scared and did my first interview on his show. And so what was it, a week or two ago, if you guys weren't here, listen in the archive. But I, in turn, then interviewed James on this show a couple weeks ago. So that was kind of a neat full circle thing too. So it's special. Neat the way that I met Matt, Minnesota Matt, and neat that I'm still in contact with James. And I thank you for your support early on and wish you the best with yours.
Thank you, Kim, very much, and enjoy. You're doing a great job.
Thanks. Thank you so much for being here. Okay, great. Well, why don't we...
Hey, Kim.
Yes.
One thing that he just touched on, I mean, did that happen for you? Were you in a coma at all? Or anybody
yeah.
else on the line?
11
days. I was for 9 weeks or whatever. And that's a very... you know, I think about all the memories of, like, you know, we're out, but then... You hear so much around you, and you put stories to all that, correct? Was that like that for you, too? Where you're like, your brain's still moving, is what I'm saying. And
inside the coma, you mean?
Yeah,
in the coma,
yeah,
you mean? All
yeah,
I can remember.
I was always putting stories to, like, what was going on around me, and my brain was still... I was still
okay, see, I don't remember conscious thought. All I remember is pain, searing pain. I don't remember conscious awareness or conscious thought. I just remember stinging pain. But during the time that the near-death experience happened, the pain was gone.
No, I guess at the time, I don't know. But, I mean, when I came out and I was, like, kind of making sense of where I was and things were flashing in and out more that way. Did that happen for anybody else?
When I was in my experience, I, like Kim, I had a lot of pain when I came out of my coma, and it was, you know, the kind of, and it was all in my head, such bad pain that made me feel nauseous in my stomach and throughout the rest of my body. You know, every part of my body felt the pain that was happening in my head, and I couldn't do anything about it. They didn't give me any pain management. They wouldn't let me have any. And that lasted for months. And particularly if I went to sleep, I would wake up with really bad, bad pain. And you can't describe it, can you, Kim?
No, it's just, no, there really isn't any, you know, like when you close your eyes and your mind is thinking about things. Mine wasn't like that. It was just such intense pain. I didn't even feel like I was even really holding on.
It's your entire existence.
I had that too. That deep throbbing pain in your brain, and I had that too. Yeah.
Yeah. Area code 585. You're on the air.
This is fantastic, Frank. How is everybody doing tonight?
We're doing fabulous, except for I've got cold feet.
Oh. Cold feet.
You got I do with putting them in a bowl of hot water, I think.
You've got cold feet and he's got a stiff neck.
You have great stories about what happened when you had your traumatic brain injury. I didn't see angels. I remember being rescued from a fire. That's it. I don't remember anything that happened until I woke up a week later. I had apparently asked for my wife, not the girl I was seeing, which changed my entire life. Because my wife, she kind of came back to help me. We've been having marital problems. We ended up getting divorced 5 years later. But the woman whom I was seeing, even though we weren't living together as man and wife anymore, I want people to think I was doing something that was wrong. The woman who I was in love with, I called her up 5 or 10 years ago. I asked her, I said, why didn't you stick by my side? And she said, because I asked for my wife. My wife was my legal guardian, and she had nothing to do with that. So that's one bad mistake I made when I woke up. But it depends on how you look at that. Because my wife, she did some things that really helped me that I'm grateful for. But that's, I don't remember meeting God or Jesus or angels or anything like that. My story is I just fell asleep. I woke up a week later when they carted me out from Strong Hospital. They took me from Genesee Hospital to Strong Hospital. I remember it was cold in the ambulance. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing I remember. I don't have any of these angel stories. And I feel kind of not perfect, not having the greatest experience in the world, so I feel kind of below you people in some ways. Does that make sense?
Yes. And not, you know, you might have and not remember, and you might not have, you know. It's hard to say, you know, the people that remember, and it might be that sometime in the future something happens that triggers a memory with you, and maybe not, hard
now,
to say.
I want to say that people are saying that they can hear people talking around them. That's why it's very important when you go into a person who is sick, who could be dying, that you don't say, oh, this is going to be Charlie's last time I'm going to visit him, because Charlie can hear you say that, and if he thinks that's what you've got to do, then he will die. This is a proven fact. And that's why I caution people who go visit people who are sick, not to give them encouragement, not to be saying, oh, this guy's going to die or he's dead or something like that, because people can hear that. It doesn't matter if they are unconscious or not.
I think that's a good point. You know, if people are in doubt out there that are listening, it doesn't necessarily mean just because a person appears to be sleeping that they can't hear what's going on. So you probably want to be judicious about the conversation you have in the presence of that person. And if you've got a thought like that on your mind, you might want to keep it to yourself and just speak in a comforting way, because when you think about it, yeah, encouraging, Jenny, because they're transitioning, and so you want to speak, as Jenny says in the chat room, kind and loving words, even if you know they're dying, you know.
Well, you have no idea if they are really dying. That is your hallucination. That could be your reality right then and there. That might not be their reality. You could be actually changing their reality for them.
I don't know. Maybe.
Don't believe that?
No, I don't think I can change their reality. Their reality is what it is, but I think you can. I talk about another instance in my book, and I'm not going to go along into that, but a dear friend of mine, and I took it very badly a number of years ago, same type of thing. He contracted some kind of horrible cancer and was dead. I mean, the whole thing was like, it was like a blur. I mean, in a, over a 5-week period. And I saw him, I went and saw him at the point that I didn't make it to see Marty, and that's when he was really not there. I looked up for a split second. I was sitting by the side of his bed, holding his hand, saying those kind, nice things, and I, in a flash, in a split second, I saw two angels at the head of his bed, like above the headboard of the bed he was in, and as quickly as I saw it, they were gone, and I knew he was going to die. And 3 hours later, after I got home, his dad called to tell me that Tom had died, and I don't think I did that. I just think I witnessed it happening.
But you might, under different circumstances, you might have said to him, hey, I see two angels. He might have died instantly. You know what?
Well, I wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have done that. But I think you bring up a good point for other people to take into account is that, yes, just because people look like they're sleeping, they may not be. So censor what you say.
Yes.
Don't say anything that you wouldn't say if they were looking right at you.
I gave a lecture on this recently, last October, I think it was, at the Valerie Austin Advanced Hypnotherapy Conference. I talked to people about the fact that even people in coma hear what you say. And there's always that many cases has happened where they've been doing surgery on somebody, and maybe the surgeon makes a slip and he says, oops, and the patient hears that and it impacts them in a big way. So you have to be very careful about what you say as a surgeon, but I don't know if they teach this to surgeons or not. I hope they do. But,
I don't think they do, but they give you that drug that makes you supposed to not remember things. That's complete rubbish.
You hear and remember everything. The drug they give you just relaxes your body, makes you completely paralyzed so that you're immobile when they're cutting you.
Yeah, I know. But they don't even have to be accountable because they say they're giving you a drug that erases your memory. Area code 803, you're live and with us.
Hello. Hello, Kim. This has been a wonderful show tonight.
Hi, Les Paul.
Hey, Les Paul. We're glad to have you here.
How are you guys doing? I've been here the whole time. How are you doing, Matt? How's everybody doing?
I had one of those rough,
insane with the migraine days, and that's why I didn't call in and talk rather than stayed on the computer and texted earlier. And plus, your story really got me. You brought tears to my eyes. I don't know if you read anything I was texting, but my mother, when she was dying with cancer, and it went to her brain, and her memory would come and go, but she always said she hoped that she didn't lose her memory before she died. She lived to be 86 years old, and she wasn't an old 86. When she was 85, she still wore high heel shoes, wore jewelry. She loved to dress up. She loved to go out, and she said, "I want to flirt with that guy over there." She was a very fun lady, and they discovered cancer in her 3 months before she died, so it hit her very suddenly. She went from being very active to being in a lot of pain and getting pale. And I said in the chat room, my mother, when she had the cancer attackers, I don't remember the name of it, but it's one of the absolute most severe, fastest kinds of cancer that exists. I mean, from not having any cancer less than 6 to 8 months ago after having the breast exam and everything, they found cancer from her intestines all the way up into her breasts and into her brain. And the doctor was just stunned.
Yeah, that was like this guy friend of mine. He was like younger than us because it would have been like a decade ago. So like mid-40s, same thing. that bad, that fast, just.
Yeah. Well,
so what happened?
My mother, she was laying there the last day of her life. It was very strange. I didn't know it was her last day. They told me that it could be 2 weeks, 2 months. We just don't know. It might be 2 days. And I had been at the hospital for, I'm guessing, 3 to 4 weeks without leaving under any. I wouldn't go to work. I wouldn't do anything. My mother was begging me, please go home. She could tell it was affecting my brain injury. I was having severe chronic migraines. I'd have to just go out of the room and rest and come back. But I wasn't sleeping at all. And she grabbed me around the neck and she said, I've known you my entire life. I love you to death. If I die tonight, you'll know I love you and I'll be in heaven, she said. But she said, you go home and I'll see you in the morning. And she didn't say it like I'm saying. She said it in a very broken voice, looked absolutely like she felt terrible. And I was crying while she was talking to me. I just couldn't quit weeping because I love my mom so much. She was such a precious, dear lady. She loved everybody and helped so many people. And she made me go home, and she said, I promise you, tomorrow we'll have a wonderful day. If you'll go home now, you look like you're going to drop dead, she said. And it took her all night just to say that, and she was crying, worried about me. So I got in the car, cried all the way home. I had to keep stopping along the highway, because I said, I hope nothing happens. I just felt like something was going to happen. But she absolutely, and she said, if you love me, and you really love me, you're going to go home. You have no choice. There's no choice. I demand that you go home, and I know you love me, so you're going to go home. And so when I got home, I just collapsed in the bed. And the next thing I remember was the phone ringing, and she had passed away. But the part I missed in between that was when we were in the room together before I left, she kept looking up at the ceiling, and she said, do you see them? And I said, see what?
She saw them.
I got goosebumps, ran up my back. I said, don't tell me she's seeing angels. I said, Mom, what is it? She said, the room is full of angels. They're touching me. She said, Les, they're all around you. And she got a great big smile, and she said, look. And I looked all around, and I had chills run down my back. When you were telling that earlier, I had tears in my eyes. I couldn't call in because of it, because it brought so much about my mother, what she went through, back to my memory. But my mother said, the room is full of them. She said, there's 15 or 20, and she said, Les, they're touching you. Do you see them? And I'm saying, Mom, you're scaring me. What do you see for real? She said, they're all around you. They're so beautiful. She kept saying, they're so beautiful. They're real. And I'm saying, okay. And I was thinking, she must be hallucinating. And she said, they even keep touching me. They're even talking to me.
They were.
She said they were talking to her and telling her that everything's all right. It's going to be okay. And then she made me go home. And so that's what set me up for, I didn't know if she was hallucinating at first, and then I started saying, she's seeing angels. I there's a strange aura about the room that I can't describe. It's impossible to recreate. But she was telling me, Les, I see angels. I know they're real. They're all around you and I, and they're loving on you too. And I said, what do you mean? She said, do you feel them? And I stood still for a second. I had the strangest feeling go all over my whole body for about 10 seconds, and it went away. And I had a chill and then peace. And I said, okay, I'm going home. I've taken your orders. I will see you very early in the morning. And I went home by 5 a.m. I got the call and told me she had passed. And I actually prayed, Lord, take her home tonight. When I was on my way home, I never dreamed I could pray that for my own mother. It was the hardest thing I ever did. But I saw the tremendous suffering she was going through, and she was there for me through all my aneurysms and all my brain surgeries. And so I just couldn't stand seeing her suffer anymore.
Right.
And so when I got to the hospital, I was terrified about what I might see, because I had seen my brother who died at age 50 of a massive heart attack, and he looked terrible, where they'd pumped on him and tried to revive him. And I remember he was swollen and looked just, I couldn't even stand the thought of seeing my mother. But my brother Ed, my last brother, he said, Les, I'm going to go in there with you. And we went into the room, and I just couldn't even, I had done everything I could do to resist going in there. And when I walked in through the doorway, the most beautiful thing laid in front of me. My mother had the most gorgeous smile on her face that you could ever imagine of someone lying there dead, and her eyes were open, and she was staring straight into the ceiling, and her hand was even partially open. They were both open, not partially, and she was looking up as if she had seen something, and it met her with a smile. I really believe she went to heaven that night.
I really believe she went with the angels. They came to get her. And her spirit got up out of her body and went.
Exactly.
And they were there. She was a protective figure for you. And the angels were around you to give you protection and let you know that she's being protected.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you think, Keith Anthony and Matt, those of you that experienced this?
Thank you very much for sharing that story, and I got goosebumps and shed a tear or two from you sharing that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I remember when my grandfather died, I'd been going to see him every day in the hospital. He was dying of cancer, and I knew that his time was coming to the end, and that's why I wanted to be with him every day. And I was by the side of his bed every day. And eventually, the nurses brought the screens around, and they made me leave the bed, and I objected. I said I didn't want to. They said you must, and I think they knew that he was about to die. They said they had to turn him over and stuff, but by the time they came out, he had gone, and I felt that I'd been cheated, because I really felt that I was supposed to be there holding his hand or something at the point when he died. So I never did get to see what happened. I've seen lots of dead people, but I've never been there at the point of death.
I haven't been there.
I did give first aid to somebody who was actually died. But,
I remember that.
I didn't see any angels or anything, because perhaps they knew he was going to be coming back.
I don't know.
Military, and I never saw any angels anywhere, I might say. And I try not to talk about those things too much, but I'm just saying where I have saw death, that was meant to be death, there's no angels.
Well,
not
you don't.
Muhammad ain't got no angels anyway.
Right. You don't know, though, those people that died on the field. I understand what you're saying, and it seems like only the evil and the kind of death that you were seeing. But those people are afforded the same God, and I'm sure the same angels were there to pick up their spirit, even
saying,
in the horrendous way it was left.
If angels aren't, if you're living, the angel ain't what you're looking for.
Yeah, you might not want to go to the battlefield.
You're not looking for an angel.
Well, there you go. There you go. Well, I do appreciate you sharing your story, Les Paul, and I just feel like I felt when Marty was talking about the person in the waistcoat, and that's just that it's a nod of understanding that what she saw is real for me, just another acceptance, another level of acceptance of that reality. And I think it's a blessing that you got to share that with her, even if it threw you off for a moment when it was happening.
Well, one of the most unusual, I don't know if unusual is the right word, one of the things I go back and think about is when I was actually begging them to take all the life support off of me when they were doing the embolization procedures on my brain because the pain was so many hundreds of, if not thousands of levels above insane beyond pain. And I was screaming, please let me die. And I didn't want to. And my mother was in the wing of the hospital, and they wouldn't allow anybody back there because it was supposed to be secure and all this stuff. But they would call my mother out and call her as close to me as she could. And this, you remember me telling you, it was outdoors what they did to me. It was insane what they did. But she would come over there and, Les Paul, please, if you're not going to fight for yourself anymore, you can't quit, you can't give up, you can't surrender, you're not that kind of person. I won't allow you to do that. If you won't live for yourself, live for me. I love you. Don't give up. And I would hear that, and the pain was just so severe, I could just barely hear her. I had resolved myself to die. I wanted to die. I hurt so bad. And I started somehow tuning into what my mother was saying, and it really, I could feel my body dying. I really felt my body sinking into nothingness. It was like I was falling into
a deep
pit.
I did too.
And I started listening to her, and suddenly I felt the energy coming back, and I really credit to her me being able to talk to you guys tonight. And I'm going to stop there because I don't want to use up all the time.
Well, no, the other thing I think you said about feeling, that fleeting feeling that you had for a moment when she said for you to look around you, I think that was the energy. It was the energy of the spiritual beings that you felt.
Yeah.
If you couldn't feel the presence of the brush of a wing or something like that, I really believe that what you felt was the energy of that presence. Presences.
It was definitely there. I could feel it very strong. It's like the room was mad. Well,
you're putting me through deja vu. This is good for everybody else, but you're making me cry again. Les and I had a private conversation a couple times last week. And you know, I still love you, brother. We've been up and down, and we've discussed
sir. Sir, yes,
I still feel the same, if not worse, damn it.
Oh.
But you know, it's all good. It's all good.
Well, Matt, you're our super advocacy hero now since this stuff you went through recently. I hope it'll turn you more into an advocate for helping people that are in very similar situations of what you went through. To help free people in similar situations.
Well, I don't want to be a specialist in any kind of advocacy. I just want to talk, get inspired by all of us, you know?
Well, you're a success story, and that's good. You know, I think all of us that had these near-death experiences, it doesn't make us you know, any more special from the next guy. It's just like, you know, you go take a class in something and you know something that I don't because you took that class. It doesn't make you, you know, we all have our information database, you know, our personal database. And, you know, some of us happen to have that NDE database memory, you know, but it doesn't, it just gives us different, you know, we're all equal but have different, you know, knowledge bases to bring to the table.
It's like that cop that come running after me and took me out and beat my head off the ground and all that. He didn't know or care that I was AmeriCorps or survived or did all this. I'm not patting myself on the back, but, you know, to him, I'm just another human being because we are human beings.
Right. We do live in the human existence, and it has rules, and it is harder, I think. I don't know. Maybe that's another conversation on an NDE show if one of us has them, and that's how it, you know, changes after, because there is a lot of things that I look at as minutia now in the human existence that I've seen the cosmic level, and it's really hard for me to behave. That might be part of the behavior problems that we have or the mood disorders that we have is really, you know, that things that used to be important are just so trivial now.
Same with
you know
me. Yeah.
right, you know, things that used to, that stresses the so-called normal life that we used to have are not there no more. And now that I look at them, they didn't really need to be there in the first place.
Well, they didn't, but we wouldn't have learned anything, you know. Apparently they did need to be there in the first place because something was going to happen that was going to cause a shift.
Yeah,
in our
what
human
a shift,
being, you know, we're still going to be human being, you know, but have a different dimension to it than was there before, I guess. And so,
even though nobody can understand us, we understand things so much more. Does that make sense?
That's true.
Yeah. That's why I think it helps, and the only reason I brought it up in the show tonight and had the attention-grabbing title, you know, The Walking Dead, was, again, just because I've heard people talk about these experiences in a fleeting way, but everybody kind of does it apologetically, you know, like you used to if you had an alcoholic in the family, you know, you weren't open about it. That was a shame thing, and you kind of whispered it under your breath, you know, Uncle Harry tips the sauce too much, you know, that kind of a thing. And you do that with NDEs and some of the stuff, you know, that's come out of your case and a lot of other things in the advocacy for TBIs and stuff. Some, you know, people think they know and they are clueless, you know, they don't have any idea, but part of it is ignorance, affectionately, she says, just being too caught up in the now of the human existence and the job. No, I'm sure, you know, in any case, the policeman didn't have a chance to know your story, you know, and unfortunately, a lot of the interactions that we have with people, all kinds of people in a day's time, you know, they can't know in the first 10 minutes that they meet us what our story is any more than we can know what their story is, you know. That's why sometimes when people act like an idiot stick to me, I try sometimes to think about the fact that it's maybe really not about me. It's about something that's going wrong in their life. And
I've discovered that about people. I really have. And they don't want to hear it sometimes because they're afraid of what we're talking about, too. I've had people tell me that, I don't want to hear that. That scares me.
Mm. Well, because we tell the honest truth, maybe?
Yes, that's exactly what I mean. Thank you.
Well, yeah, anything that's different or not part of the status quo can be scary for people. It's like,
sure.
But what's funny, I think, about that is, to me, it took away the fear of the unknown. And if they believe what they hear, if these people believe what they hear, and maybe they didn't believe Keith Anthony, maybe they didn't believe me, maybe they didn't believe Matt, but do you really not believe all of us?
Right.
and all the other people out there that aren't even on this radio show, and now you can find a way to deny.
Right.
You know?
I wish my family would listen to these radio shows, not even mine, just yours and Les's and everybody, so they could get a hint of what it's like, what I've had to live through, what you folks and what people like us have had to live through. And my family has no concept. They just say, well, you're alive, you're okay.
did
we had to bury you four times.
Matt,
that's anywhere in the world, unfortunately.
I have an idea from
that. I understand. You know, you can only go through a person that you love dearly dying so many times on you. You know, you're going to have to wear out doing it after a while.
Well, I think you don't want to see a person suffer. And then, Frank, I know you're trying to say something, so I'll let you say something. But I just want to say real quick that we've had a person named Ellis on the board, and I won't unmute your call, Ellis, but I haven't seen you before. And just in case you didn't know, if you want to talk, you need to press 1, and that will show me a little signal that tells me that you want to talk. And otherwise, I'll just thank you for being here and respect the fact that you're
just
listening.
Your guest just left. I think he ran away.
The person I'm talking about is on the switchboard. So, anyway.
Can I bring your attention to that link that I put in?
I just clicked it.
Yeah, there was a man who was in a hospital bed for 23 years, diagnosed as being brain dead. And he was actually awake and alert. He just couldn't move. That's called locked-in syndrome. I talked about that as well on that talk that I did at the Advanced Hypnotherapy Conference, because I was locked in for a little while. Not 23 years, thank God. But I was locked in when I couldn't communicate and I couldn't let them know that I was awake. But they were just treating me as if I was still in coma all that time. But 23 years, my God. Can you imagine what it must be like to be unable to communicate at all for 23 years?
No, I would just pray that if there was a plug, that somebody would pull mine, that's all.
But he's communicating now with a single finger that he can move now. Once they monitored him and realized that he'd been alert all those years, they started to help him. And now he can communicate with just one finger.
Cool.
That's going to be a heck of a story to follow. It really
is.
That person is obviously meant to be here, but boy, I don't get that whole thing. Yes, Les?
Matt, I was going to talk about what Les Paul was speaking about before, about how he owes a lot of to his mother. And I was thinking back in my accident when I was in the hospital and I was in a coma, my mother would come in and check on me every day, and she would hold my hand and tell me to squeeze her hand. And then one day I squeezed her hand and they took me off these drugs that kept me induced in a coma, and I came out of it.
Right.
I mean, all these positive words and talking to me while I was in a coma, I believe that really helped me to I have a strong mother, just like it sounds Les Paul had a strong mother that was helping.
Yeah.
Probably all of us, we had a lot of loved ones around us, and that helped us a lot. So
that's absolutely right. I know my parents, had never left my side during that, nor my fiance at the time. There were a lot of people pulling for me, and I had been in an unrelated recovery group for 7 years when my brain exploded, and so there was a full waiting room and a lot of prayers that were going up on my behalf, and I'm grateful for that, and I believe that they were heard. A lot of people, that were following my story as it was unfolding and there to watch it. Yet, interestingly, I couldn't, they were all there when it was happening, but the rest of it, only you guys know. Because that's the part they can't witness, because I look like I did before. But nobody can see your insides, and that they process different and feel different, and I think are biologically different just because of the invasion. I don't see how you could possibly be invaded like that and not be rewired, you know, like spilling a Coke on your keyboard. Any of you that have done that, yeah, you know, it fries a couple of the boards there, you know, but people can't see that, you know, and that leads to some of those problems, having, you know, people having an expectation that we're the same person we were before, and how frustrating that is, you know. And Matt was talking about the dying over and over and over again, you know, yeah, you know, die or get well, but it's hard to cope. You know, you want somebody, if they're sick, to get better, and the healthier and more like their old selves they look, the more they want and expect you to be that person that you were before. And they can't imagine that your insides just like drained out and got dumped back in a different order or something. I don't know. I don't even know how to explain that. That's why I don't really talk to people about it, except here.
My mother, I just wanted to say one. She was a really cool, tough lady. She said that when she saw how bad I was doing, and they didn't think I was going to make it out of it at all several different times, and my heart would stop beating and all kinds of different things just kept going on. When I came home, she said, "He's not the same man. I've got to somehow find out a way to accept it." She said she went in the room, closed the door, got on her knees, and cried for about 2 hours over me, and just wept like a baby, she said. And she said, "I've lost the son I used to have." And she said when she got up, she said, "Okay, now let me go help my new son and start over new." And from that day forward, she said, he didn't die, but in a sense, you did, Les. But you're still the same person. I still see a lot of the same person in you there. She said, "I see a better person now." She said, "And I had to do what I did because I realized I lost you, and you did come back, but it's a different you. And we all are different in some way than we used to be, sometimes by a gigantic amount, sometimes by a smaller amount." And that's what she meant. And when she did that, I said, "What a cool mom I've got." She really got it to be up in her years like she did.
Absolutely. Well, since you're talking about moms and we're running down to when we'll get cut off, I'll share something to you. This is in my book, and my mom, you know, your family, they weren't sleeping a lot with on that week where I was really touch and go, and apparently she did a little journaling and gave me some cards, but this is something my mom wrote. It says, "Commitment takes on many shapes. Your dad and I, without ever needing to voice it out loud, made a silent but very firm commitment to see you through this, whatever direction it took. Our total and complete focus became you and whatever day held for all of us. One moment at a time, we three were on a mission. Be strong, our precious angel. Stay with us. Hang on. The surgery is Friday. We are right here with you. You are being so brave and courageous. We love you so much, and we're praying. The bonds of love and the commitment between the three of us filled that tiny ICU room with all of the noise, the buzzing and beeping sounds of all of the equipment. Something kept running through my mind over and over. wherever two or three are gathering in my name, there I am, and he was. Reflections from Mom, January 1995. And if this is the ninth, this would actually be the 18th anniversary of my brain rupture.
Oh, wow.
So, in there.
Yeah. All choked up.
Well, since we're all choked up and we have about 4 minutes left, what I'm going to do, because we've been talking about it all the way around, and you guys will all know it from the angel to the mother to everything else, is I'm going to close the show with the song in its entirety by Leah West. I urge you to check her out at leahwest.com, who was kind enough to let me use this song on Brain Injury Radio, as well as the trailer of my book. But this is something that I believe we all have, and thank you all so much for being here tonight. I really appreciate your support and understanding, and thank you for being here. So here's to our guardian angel. Good night, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye.
As you grow.